beyond their social horizon. We found that happy people tend to be located in the center of their social networks and to be located in large clusters of other happy people. And we found that each additional happy friend increases a person's probability of being happy by about 9%. For comparison, having an extra $5,000 in income, in 1984 dollars, increased the probability of being happy by about 2%. Happiness, in short, is not merely a function of personal experience, but also is a property of groups. But what of life since 2003? Do our more prominent and ever-present digital walls filter out emotions rather than encourage them? Can happiness still spread in a world of bits and bytes? The answer, they found, is yes, if we can see that people are smiling. Christakis and Fowler followed up their first study by looking at a group of 1,700 college students interconnected by Facebook. They reviewed their online profiles, determined their closest friends, and this time studied everyone's photographs, noting those who were smiling in the photos and those who were not. They then mapped the pictures based on who was smiling and who was not. Each student was represented by a node, and each line between two nodes indicated that the connected individuals were tagged in a photo together. Students who were smiling and surrounded by smiling people in their network were colored yellow. Students who were frowning and surrounded by the same countenance were colored blue. And finally, green nodes indicated a mix of smiling and non-smiling friends. The map showed in vivid fashion how strongly the yellow nodes, smilers, and blue nodes, frowners, clustered together, with the yellow clusters proving to be much larger and more populated than the blues. Additionally, the non-smilers seemed to be located more peripherally in the network, primarily on the outskirts of the map. This came as no surprise to Christakis and Fowler, who noted, "Statistical analysis of the network shows that people who smile tend to have more friends. Smiling gets you an average of one extra friend, which is pretty good considering that people only have about 6 close friends. Not only that, but the statistical analyses confirm that those who smile are measurably more central to the network compared to those who do not smile. That is, if you smile, you are less likely to be on the periphery of the online world." In their final thoughts, after noting the large and frequent number of node clusters surrounding smiling people and the remote and peripherally peppered nodes of frowning people, they wrote, "It thus seems to be the case, online as well as offline, that when you smile, the world smiles with you." There is a simple reason for this phenomenon. When we smile, we are letting people know we are happy to be with them, happy to meet them, happy to be interacting with them. They in turn feel happier to be dealing with us. To someone who has seen a dozen people frown, scowl, or turn their faces away, your smile is like the sun breaking through the clouds. Your smile is often the first messenger of your goodwill. Of course, we don't always feel like smiling, but if we make the effort, we not only make those around us happier, but also become happier ourselves. You may not be a particularly exuberant, outgoing person, but a simple smile takes little effort, and the rewards can be astonishing. For the past decade, as email and texting have supplanted oral communication, we've been seduced by the fallacious notion that we live in an emotional desert. Entrepreneurs, business owners, and many professionals can carry on business with only a minimum of tactile interaction. Many modern two-dimensional media allow all of us, at one time or another, to forget about the importance of a smile. In many ways, texts and emails of today are like the telegraph messages of old, which had their own share of troubles. A reporter once telegraphed actor Cary Grant about his age. "How old Cary Grant?" the message read. The actor replied, "Old Cary Grant fine. How you?" Clearly, the human proclivity toward misunderstanding is high. Throw in technology, and it becomes all the more inevitable. Where telegrams were once ubiquitous, today's technology can be suffocating. In 1929, at the telegram's peak, 200 million of them were sent. By April 2010, nearly 300 billion email messages were sent every day. Pile on a daily worldwide barrage of text messages, instant messages, and Facebook wall posts, and it is a small wonder the world hasn't descended into anarchy. Thank goodness for smiles, which can do a better job of clarifying our messages than anything, even if they take the form of traditional emoticons, little faces composed of ordinary keyboard characters designed to give much-needed context for our communications. Recognizing the limitations of these symbols, the three largest Japanese cell phone companies, NTT Docomo, AU, and SoftBank Mobile, created emojis, color pictures displaying a broad range of emotions and symbols to better emulate the face-to-face experience. Google has now adopted them for its email platform, and they are being rapidly integrated into iPhones. Yet, while these clever little symbols are endearing, they are unlikely to appear within your next digital message to a board member, a problem employee, or a prospective client. Emoticons are largely for use in casual conversations, and in such contexts they serve well. How then do we smile across all media, and, when necessary, maintain a certain level of professionalism in the process? There is little doubt that letting another see your smile is most effective, but because so many of our interactions today are not face-to-face, you must turn your resources toward overcoming the obstacles to exhibiting friendliness across digital space. It may be simpler than you think. Outside of emoticons and emojis, there is only one medium in which you can convey a digital smile: your voice, whether it is written or spoken. How you write an email, the tone you use, and the words you choose are critical tools of friendliness and subsequent influence. Your written words are like the corners of your mouth. They turn up, they remain straight, or they turn down. The subsequent effect, whether the words garner friendships and influence, has much to do with the linear trajectory of the emotion they convey. Smile through your written words, and you convey to others that their well-being is important to you. You and your message will have the best chance of being received. Frown through your words, and others will often frown on the message and messenger. These conclusions certainly do not take account for those occasions when a more serious tone ought to be taken. Still, a good rule of thumb here is to make sure the linear thread of the message trends upward. Always begin and end the message on a positive note rather than on a pessimistic or detached one. Between two people, there is nearly always a reason to smile. If you can't see a reason, then perhaps you need to wait before you write, or not write at all. As many relationships have been damaged by insensitive knee-jerk notes as by verbal insults or tirades. The reason is simple. Written words and their effect are permanent and largely irrefutable. While you might argue against your email's negative or tactless tone, the echoing effect it has on its recipient is nearly impossible to silence. And today, that effect can multiply quickly, damaging relations between employees, departments, and even entire value chains. According to a recent issue of Fast Company, new research is adding a twittery flavor to the old adage, "birds of a feather flock together," because it suggests happy Twitterers tend to aggregate. The article goes on to explain, "Above many other factors that cause people to aggregate together, people who are sad or happy tend to communicate on Twitter with other people who are sad or happy." The research team, including University of Indiana professor Johan Bolin, analyzed the tweet streams from 102,000 Twitter users over 6 months, examining 129 million tweets. According to Bolin, the analysis used standard algorithms borrowed from psychological research to assess the subjective well-being of users from their tweets by looking for trends in positive or negative words. Then they looked at aggregation trends and found that happier people are more usually found retweeting and messaging other Twitter users who are also happy. The same is true for unhappy people. From the findings, Bolin suggests a tweet is more infectious than we realize, and very effectively communicates joy or sadness. People who are happy would then tend to prefer, on average, happier fellow tweeters because they echo their own emotions. The fact remains, if you can't convey the proper amount of positive emotion in a written note, you are better off leaving the page blank, or perhaps even inserting an emoji, to the detriment of your professional reputation. There are worse things, in other words, than being thought a bit unprofessional. Avoiding negative sentiment with your written words altogether is obviously the goal. It is largely possible. Perhaps it is time to rethink the value of those writing skills your teachers insisted would be necessary one day. They were right, after all. The other way in which you convey your digital voice, your spoken words, has heavy implications as well. How you speak, the tone in your voice, and the words you choose often express more than the words themselves. You have no doubt heard the retort, "Your actions speak so loudly, I can hardly hear a word you are saying." It is just as true to assert, "Your tone speaks so loudly, I can hardly hear a word you are saying." Asserting you are glad to meet someone on a phone call means little if said with minimal facial movement and no positive inflection. It simply comes across that you are bored or busy with something more important, or worse, the complete opposite message, that meeting the person is an unpleasant proposition. Avoiding such situations begins in the same way it would begin if you were standing in front of the person. Numerous studies have shown that the physical act of smiling, even while on a phone call, actually improves the tone in which your words are conveyed. It is no coincidence that one of the central tenets that all speaking, singing, and broadcasting coaches drill into their students is that your voice sounds more pleasant, more inviting, and more compelling when you are smiling. A smile, in other words, translates across wires, whether or not the person on the receiving end can see your face. When seeking influence that leads to positive change, there is no sidestepping the door of healthy human relations. A smile opens this door, whether it's visible, written, or verbal. Rosalind Picard is a professor at the MIT Media Lab and internationally known for her book, Effective Computing, about giving technology emotional qualities that help people communicate more effectively. The advances she highlights are nothing short of staggering. Machines with faces that can respond appropriately to reprimands or praise, encouragement or rebuke. Of course, these machines are merely responding to pre-programmed commands, much as a computer screen responds when a key is pushed. These machines mimic physical cues, words, and verbal tone, yet they do not feel. It is worth noting that humans can program such technology. This fact alone provides compelling evidence of how well we know pat responses to others' cues, words, and tone. We are wired in the same way we wire our technologies, only with feeling to boot. There are two kinds of people, blogged media maven Chris Brogan. Those who see the computer slash internet slash buttons as being attached to human, feeling beings, and those who think it's just online and that it doesn't attach. That's like saying the phone is just something to talk into and there's no emotions there either. It's not just online. People do have feelings that they associate to these at-a-distance places. Yes, people overreact. We agree there. But to dismiss emotions simply because of the medium would be to dismiss letters, telephones, pictures, etc. Lots of things happen at a distance and yet convey consequences. I think there are most definitely two sets of minds at work, and this describes slash defines a lot of those times when one side or the other feels misunderstood. Just remembering this one detail and realizing which of the two people you're dealing with and which one others perceive you to be, and things might get better. Emotions, it seems, are the boundless gifts and burdens that humans carry. This can either discourage or encourage. Your mouth has a lot to say about your choice. A smile, someone once said, costs nothing but gives much. It enriches those who receive without making poorer those who give. It takes but a moment, but the memory of it sometimes lasts forever. None is so rich or mighty that he cannot get along without it, and none is so poor that he cannot be made rich by it. Yet a smile cannot be bought, begged, borrowed, or stolen, for it is something that is of no value to anyone until it is given away. Some people are too tired to give you a smile. Give them one of yours, as none needs a smile so much as he who has no more to give. Smile. It increases your face value. Chapter 3. Rain with Names. On March 10, 2010, a press release skittered through the wires at Quinn, Emanuel, Urquhart, Oliver & Hedges, one of American lawyers' top 100 law firms. John Quinn and Eric Emanuel, who founded the company 25 years earlier, were naming a new partner, Kathleen M. Sullivan. Sullivan, one of the nation's top litigators and former dean of Stanford Law School, had been credentialed at Cornell, Harvard Law, and Oxford. She'd been First Lady Michelle Obama's professor at Harvard, and praise for her legal mind, acumen, and talent was universal. Her adversaries knew how tough a legal foe she was. Her appointment was well-deserved. Law firms, like all companies, make changes to their businesses from time to time. Associates come and go, paralegals and assistants as well. Partner turnover is much rarer, but it is hardly uncommon. Why was this particular appointment so significant? Kathleen Sullivan was not just named a partner. She became a named partner. The new firm would henceforth be called Quinn, Emanuel, Urquhart, and Sullivan. To be named a partner in a law firm is especially significant, all the more at a prestigious firm. But what put Sullivan's appointment into rare air was that she immediately became the first woman ever to be named a partner at one of America's top 100 law firms. From 1870, when Ada H. Kepley became the first woman to graduate from a law school, to 2010, no other top firm had made space on its door for a woman's name. But no more. A name was embraced and a barrier broken. Quinn wrote, "Her inclusion in the firm's name reflects the integration of our trial and appellate practices and our strengths as a national law firm." There is power in a person's name. More than a word, it is a verbal symbol of something much deeper and more meaningful. This is not just the case for groundbreakers such as Kathleen Sullivan. From ancient to modern literature, a person's name was not merely a moniker. It was a revelation of character, personality, and fate. Apollo, Abraham, and Atticus. Cosette, Scarlet, Cinderella, and Pollyanna. In Roman times, a name was so closely identified with who a person was that when a criminal's name was removed from the civic register, all the rights of citizenship vanished. To this day, certain tribes in Africa believe an individual's given name is the primary force that determines his or her skills, decisions, and ultimately, life's destiny. Is there any reason to believe a person's name is any less important today? It is perhaps more so, but it has become primarily the case in a commercial context. This represents opportunities and problems. In the digital age, names are like company logos, identifying not only who one is, but also what one represents, likes and dislikes, yays and nays. The hundreds of millions of bloggers, tweeters, and Facebookers surely want their voices heard, but they also want their names known. Twitter and Facebook in particular have done more than simply add to an information-based economy. They have also created a new kind of name-based economy in which we are largely known by the name we brand and campaign to the world. This sort of recognition can now be monetized, of course, giving new meaning to the phrase household name. On Twitter and blogs, your commercial worth is commensurate with the number of names following you. As your following grows, publishing contracts, advertising agreements, and endorsement deals increase not only in viability, but also in value. Technorati top 100 blogger Reed Drummond is a great example. A University of California, Los Angeles graduate with big plans to practice law in a big city, she met and married her Marlboro man husband while on a pit stop in Oklahoma, as she put it. Plans for law school in Chicago went out the window, and she moved to her husband's fourth-generation cattle ranch and took on her new moniker, Pioneer Woman. Drummond began blogging in 2006 as a way to keep friends and family apprised of her unexpected but gratifying life. By 2009, she had approximately 2 million readers and site traffic in the eight-figure range monthly. By 2010, she had two lucrative book contracts and two subsequent New York Times bestsellers, and she was earning approximately $1 million a year from blog ad sales alone. It is clear that our own names can hold value today, but lest we be tempted to forget, knowing others' names can lead to greater success. Dave Munson, founder of the Saddleback Leather Company, knows this well. He was a volunteer English teacher in Mexico when he had his first leather bag made from a design he drew for a local leather worker. The bag garnered so much attention on his hometown streets of Portland, Oregon, he decided to return to Mexico immediately and have more made. A month later, Munson returned to Portland with eight bags in tow and sold them all from the safari rack of his old Land Cruiser in 3 hours. The Saddleback Leather Company was born, and with it, the goal to love people around the world by making excessively high-quality, tough, and functional leather designs. His secret? Munson frequently fields customer calls from his cell phone and returns online questions via phone or email. He also travels to Mexico multiple times each year to stay connected with the Mexican leather workers still making his bags. The visits aren't showmanship. "I hug the workers and ask them how I can pray for them," he explained in a recent interview. "When I first started taking the trips, I remember how shocked these men were that I would call them by name and then sit down and talk to them about their personal lives. One got tears in his eyes. Then, so did I." He doesn't share these personal stories on his blog or in his marketing literature because he believes promising to do something is different from simply producing it. Saddleback is proud, he says, to remain a family business despite selling millions of dollars worth of leather goods each year. "I've heard horror stories of lots of small and successful businesses who, driven by greed, try to become giants and fail," Munson writes on his blog. "We aren't like that. We are and will maintain our family of leather owners with love. Pretty much every day I lay down in bed with my hot wife and we talk about different bag owners who we've been going back and forth with. We want to know your name." It is this level of personal touch, putting people's names before product names and profits, that makes one surmise Saddleback Leather will be around as long as one of his leather bags, which carries the tagline, "They'll fight over it when you're dead." The opportunities to be known by others and to know others are ultimately two sides of the same coin. There is branding, the introduction of you to others, and then there is relationship building, the interaction between you and others. What is interesting is that you can forego the former and still be successful. You can be so good at building relationships that your interactions with others birth and sustain your brand. Conversely, you cannot sustain success on branding alone. You cannot brand yourself or your business and then forego building relationships. In the end, business is still about one person relating to another. Mr. Bates, from Watkinsville, Georgia, experienced this firsthand. He is a business owner who always takes his top out-of-town suppliers to Bones, a famous Atlanta restaurant some 70 miles away. His loyalty, however, wasn't born of their exquisite menu, branded as well as any in North America. It started with a waiter named James. As Mr. Bates and a supplier pulled up to their table one evening, James approached promptly. "Hello, Mr. Bates," he said. Thank you for choosing Bones. It is a pleasure to have you back. To hear Mr. Bates describe it, it was no insignificant moment. It changed the dining experience and imprinted that restaurant in my mind. I'd only dined there once before, 6 months earlier, and James not only knew my name, he took the time to discover I'd been there before. I was by no means a regular, but the small gesture made me feel like one. It was the old adage about treating someone like the person you want him to become coming true. For such a small gesture, it paid big dividends. I don't take my suppliers anywhere else now, said Mr. Bates. Judging by the popularity of Bones, it would seem many customers share his sentiment. This is the primary business payoff of remembering people's names. They remember you. The flip side is an unenviable place to be. One of the first lessons a politician learns is this. To recall a voter's name is statesmanship. To forget is oblivion. It is one trait that unites most of history's great leaders. From Lincoln to Churchill to Bonaparte, these men figured out ways to remember people's names with surprising consistency. In so doing, they recalled, knowingly or not, a famous Emerson saying, "Good manners are made up of petty sacrifices." When it comes to remembering names, some sacrifices may be required. Napoleon III, Emperor of France and nephew of the great Napoleon Bonaparte, claimed he could remember the name of every person he met despite all of his royal duties. How? If he didn't hear the name distinctly, he said, "So sorry, I didn't get the name clearly." Then, if it was an unusual name, he would say, "How is it spelled?" During the conversation, he took the trouble to repeat the name several times and tried to associate it in his mind with the person's features, expression, and general appearance. If the person was of special importance to him, he later wrote the name down on a piece of paper, looked at it, concentrated on it, fixed it securely in his mind, and then tore up the paper. In this way, he gained a visual impression of the name as well as an audible impression. Our challenges today are far greater than Napoleon's. Numerous studies show that the only thing worse than television for our attention span is the Internet. A blur of 140-word tweets, Facebook news feeds, emails, instant messages, and web pages are beginning to rewire our brains. In a May 2010 issue of Wired, author Nicholas Carr revealed that a professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, had discovered that just 5 hours on the Internet rerouted people's neural pathways. Carr noted, "Dozens of studies by psychologists, neurobiologists, and educators point to the same conclusion. When we go online, we enter an environment that promotes cursory reading, hurried and distracted thinking, and superficial learning. Even as the Internet grants us easy access to vast amounts of information, it is turning us into shallow thinkers, literally changing the structure of our brain." In 2010, famed film critic Roger Ebert blogged, "There's such a skitterish impatience in our society right now." He's right. But such reality doesn't give us an excuse for forgetting people's names. Instead, it provides us with a challenge. As more and more people find it more and more difficult to remember names, there is enormous advantage to be gained by those who do. How? There are some easy ways. Instead of defaulting to hollow, truncated greetings such as "hey" or "hi," default to a greeting that uses the person's name, "Dear Robin," or "Good morning, Robert." When you do, practice Napoleon's technique and visualize the person's face. If you've taken the advice of earlier chapters and sought to take interest in the person's interests, impress your mind with those as well. Robert is married with 3 daughters, and he likes reading Ernest Hemingway. It's a simple exercise that will not only help you greet Robert by name the next time you interact, it will also go a long way to helping you consistently view him outside a mere transactional context. A quick tip here. Before you use people's names, make sure you know them in the right context. Today, most people have more than one name to which they answer. Celebrated entrepreneur Richard Branson is Richard to many friends, but he is also Mr. Branson to many acquaintances and Sir Richard to many fellow Brits. While we are a far less formal society at large, using a person's name out of context is a good way to get a relationship off on the wrong foot. Susan or Susie, Ben or Benjamin, Jacqueline or Jackie. The best advice is to avoid guessing. Don't call Richard Richie, Rich, or Dick in an email unless he's been introduced as such, he's asked you to use that name, or he's referred to himself with that name in a voicemail, text message, or email to you. If you've not been introduced and have never corresponded, do a little homework on what people in your same relational position are calling him. Don't check to see what his Facebook or Twitter friends call him. At this point, you're not yet his friend and have not earned the right to call him a more casual name. Instead, review how he refers to himself on his website or blog. If there is an article written about him or in which he is referenced, use that name. We must remember that a person is more interested in his or her own name than in all the other names on earth put together. Remember that name and use it easily, and you have paid a subtle and very effective compliment. But forget it or misspell it, and you have placed yourself at a sharp disadvantage. While many choose the safer alternative and address a person with terms such as man, ma'am, and sir, you can place yourself in the same person's better graces by taking the time to not only remember, but also use his or her name. Many of the salutation pitfalls we fear are easily avoidable with a few minutes' worth of research. Aren't a few minutes of your time worth it if it means standing out from the crowd? If it means making a better impression than most people make on others? If you want others to remember and use your name, a small investment is necessary. People have names coming at them in all forms all day long. People's names, company names, brand names, street names, and store names. What will set yours apart? Largely, the emotions people associate with your name. If you're just another waiter in just another restaurant in Atlanta, a metropolitan area of more than 5 million people, you will be no more memorable than the numbers on your license plate or the color of your shirt. Your name will do little to trigger emotions that connect others to you. It is no coincidence that Mr. Bates easily remembered James's name after only one encounter. He estimates he dines out about 12 times a month. When asked if he remembers other waiters' names, he replied, "I barely remember my own some days." We should always be aware of the magic contained in a person's name and realize that this word is wholly and completely owned by the person with whom we are dealing and nobody else. It is a person's trademark. After the gift of life, a person's name is the first gift he or she received. When this word is used in conversation, the information we are discussing or the connection we are seeking takes on greater meaning. Perhaps a doctor's office provides the best evidence. There is an ongoing debate in the medical world about how and when first names should be used. Does a first name basis over-personalize interactions that are best kept in a professional realm? Or would a first name basis help in the process of health and healing, and particularly in the process of discussing very difficult prognoses? It would seem that most doctors believe professionalism is important and first names are best kept at bay. Yet doctors' offices are typically places where patients feel dehumanized. They are folders and cases, not faces and feelings. Their names are frequently mispronounced or mistaken altogether, only serving to highlight a potentially dangerous disconnection. One high-profile doctor decided to buck the trend. Dr. Howard Fine is the head of the neuro-oncology program at the National Institutes of Health. In that capacity, he performs original research, oversees and distributes all of NIH's funding, and is the hands-on doctor for as many brain cancer patients as want to see him, free of charge, since it is a government program. When patients arrive to see him for the first time, they are largely hopeless. They've seen the statistics on the internet. They've heard horror stories. Dr. Fine views part of his job as restoring hope, responsible hope. How he handles names plays a leading role in this process. He estimates he's seen more than 20,000 patients over the years, and one of the ways he has chosen to interact is by introducing himself as Howard Fine, without the doctor designation. From there, his patients are encouraged to call him by his first name. It takes the relationship to another level, whereby he is no longer a detached doctor trying to keep them from dying. He is a highly educated friend, wise confidant, and fierce advocate who will fight for their full recovery. He is not in the business of blowing smoke. Instead, he understands that because the sharing of facts is both important and poignant for his patients, the establishment of rapport is essential for their well-being. What brain tumor patients need more than a doctor is a trusted advisor who understands. This is achieved more naturally when the doctor puts himself on the same level of his patients, a fellow human with a strong desire to live. It would be easy for a prominent physician to find power in the doctor moniker, but a big part of what makes Fine's program the crown jewel of the National Institutes of Health, according to one of the institute's heads, is that he recognizes that first names are more powerful and purposeful than detached ranks or bestowed titles. It is why Carnegie insisted names are the sweetest and most important sound in any language. Chapter 4. Listen Longer. How do you get the job, land the client, increase your influence, and not lose $180 million in market capitalization? Listen. In March 2008, the members of a little-known indie band from Canada were on their way to Nebraska for a week-long tour. The first leg of their United Airlines flight landed in Chicago. As the guys began to deplane, they heard a woman behind them exclaim, "They're throwing guitars out there!" They pressed their noses up against the windows to see for themselves. The woman was right. Their guitars were being tossed and dropped and tossed again onto the luggage cart. One of those guitars, a $3,500 Taylor, belonged to the band's lead singer, Dave Carroll, who immediately tried telling a flight attendant what was happening. On his website, he explains she cut him off. "Don't talk to me," she said. "Talk to the lead agent outside." He went outside, where another employee never took the time to listen to his complaint. A third employee dismissed him, saying, "But hun, that's why we make you sign the waiver." He explained that he hadn't signed a waiver and that no waiver would excuse what many people on the plane had seen. She told him to wait until Omaha to talk to someone. Not surprisingly, when he opened his guitar case, he discovered it had been badly damaged. Thus began a year-long odyssey in which Dave Carroll tried to get someone at United Airlines to listen. During those 12 months, every United employee Carroll spoke with told him what to do, but none bothered to listen to him. At one point, they told him to bring the guitar to Chicago for inspection. He had long since returned to his home in Canada, some 1,500 miles away. In the meantime, Carroll had the guitar fixed for $1,200. He was a professional musician and needed the primary tool of the trade, but the sound wasn't the same. He told United he would settle with them for the repair bill. His request fell on deaf ears. But a traveling songwriter always has two things, something to say and a means to say it. If United wouldn't listen, perhaps his music audience would. Carroll sat down and wrote a song called United Breaks Guitars, and on July 6, 2009, he uploaded a video of it to YouTube. He hoped for 1 million views in the first year. People listened far more than he anticipated. 2 weeks after it premiered, the video had nearly 4 million views. Within days, the Times of London revealed the gathering thunderclouds of bad PR caused United Airlines' stock price to suffer a mid-flight stall, and it plunged by 10%, costing shareholders $180 million, which, incidentally, would have bought Carol more than 51,000 replacement guitars. The power of listening is the power to change hearts and minds. More consequentially, it is the power of giving people what they most desire, to be heard and understood. Seismic founder Loïc Lemur maintains that the very idea of online ad campaigns is passé. The key for any and every company is a long-term engagement program that facilitates listening to customers. Online ad campaigns have so much promise, though. They can deliver a demographic profile unlike any other medium. Your company wants a 23-year-old female computer programmer who likes basket weaving? There's almost certainly a site where she can be found. Such profiling has long been the dream of advertisers everywhere. How could this not work? It doesn't work, Lemur says, because generating impressions or exposure simply isn't how the world works. Rather, it works through listening and building up trust. This process is a slow one, but one that will always bear fruit. During the darkest hours of the Civil War, Lincoln wrote to an old friend in Springfield, Illinois, asking him to come to Washington. Lincoln said he had some problems he wanted to discuss with him. The old neighbor got to Washington as quickly as he could. Lincoln talked to him for hours about the advisability of issuing a proclamation freeing the slaves. He went over all the arguments for and against such a move, and then read letters and newspaper articles, some denouncing him for not freeing the slaves, and others denouncing him for fear he was going to free them. After the long conversation, Lincoln shook hands with his old friend, said goodnight, and sent him back to Illinois without ever asking for his opinion. Lincoln had done all of the talking, but the talking seemed to clarify his mind. He seemed to feel easier after that talk, the old friend said. Lincoln hadn't wanted advice. He had wanted a sympathetic, trusted listener to whom he could unburden himself. Ultimately, it is what we all seek at one time or another. The question is whether you are discerning enough to be a burden lifter. When President Coolidge became vice president, Channing H. Cox succeeded him as governor of Massachusetts and came to Washington to call on his predecessor. Cox was impressed by the fact that Coolidge was able to see a long list of callers every day and yet finish his work at 5 p.m., while Cox found that he was often detained at his desk up to 9 o'clock. "How come the difference?" he asked Coolidge. "You talk back," said Coolidge. Listening's power, like that of smiling, is strong. When you listen well, you not only make an instant impression, you also build a solid bridge for lasting connection. Who can resist being around a person who suspends his thoughts in order to value yours? Few people in modern times have listened as well as Sigmund Freud. A man who once met him described his manner of listening. "It struck me so forcibly that I shall never forget him. He had qualities which I had never seen in any other man. Never had I seen such concentrated attention. There was none of that piercing, soul-penetrating gaze business. His eyes were mild and genial. His voice was low and kind. His gestures were few. But the attention he gave me, his appreciation of what I said, even when I said it badly, was extraordinary. You've no idea what it meant to be listened to like that." One might argue that people such as Freud, Lincoln, and others in an age gone by had it easier. Their world was smaller and certainly more controlled. There is some truth to this argument, but not anything that provides us an excuse. Yes, our age is broader and far more untamed, but we made it so. And it is therefore we who can make such traits work in our favor. Unfortunately, it seems many haven't yet figured it out. While our circle of influence balloons well beyond our neighbors and work colleagues to encompass, primarily through Facebook, much of our relational history, such an expansive network that numbers in the hundreds, if not the thousands, seems to be overwhelming to most. While the number of people to whom we might listen has expanded, the number of people to whom we actually listen is diminishing. A recent study profiled in the American Sociological Review reveals that people are growing more socially isolated than they were even 20 years ago. Overall, the number of people Americans have in their closest circle of confidants has dropped from around 3 to about 2. Whereas nearly 3/4 of people in 1985 reported they had a friend in whom they could confide, only half in 2004 said they could count on such support. The number of people who said they counted a neighbor as a confidant dropped by more than half, from about 19% to about 8%. We're not saying people are completely isolated, notes Lynn Smith Lovin, a Duke University sociologist who helped conduct the study. They may have 600 friends on Facebook and email 25 people a day, but they are not discussing matters that are personally important. More so than when this book was first published in 1936, there is a crying need for people who will make the time to listen, for people who will resist the skitterish impatience so prevalent in our age and make people more important than progress. It is, of course, absurd to believe progress can be made without the fidelity of other people, but we usually don't see this until other people let us know, with their eyes, with their silence, with their closed wallets. There are few new tips that can create a personal or corporate cache of better listening. But there is one principle that, if applied daily, can reconnect you with others on a lasting level. Presence. A martyred spiritual ambassador once framed the principle this way: wherever you are, be all there. John, an aspiring political writer, understood this principle far earlier in life than his peers. His claim is that he's never given a bad job interview. For every interview, he's received an offer. But what is perhaps most interesting is that there has rarely been anything on paper to suggest he was the best fit. I have, more often than not, he admits, been an average prospect on paper. To what, then, does he attribute his uncommon interview success rate? A counterintuitive perspective on interviews. He explains, every interview is a chance to learn something new about people I've never met. Think about it. The environment is conducive to it. There's already a natural give and take. In my interviews, I've learned about everything from culinary tastes to dashed dreams to crazy hopes. People want to be listened to, and they want people around who will listen. So I listen. And I found that listening imparts a great deal of respect, more so than any planned speech ever could. So it turns out that listening also garners great respect. And John's rare interview presence has translated into rare opportunities. He has served as both a CIA agent and a White House speechwriter. When asked for suggestions on embodying his level of presence with others, he says his personal goal is to ask 15 questions per day. The most important 5, he explains, are to your family or those in closest proximity to you. Sure, ask about their day, but go deeper. Ask what made them laugh, or perhaps what made them cry. Ask them about a lesson they learned or a person they met whom they liked. The next 5 are for the people with whom you work on a regular basis. John says, the old truth that there are no bad questions may or may not be true in a brainstorming session. It is certainly true when done with sincerity in a conversation with another person. If you ask with respect and interest, you cannot go wrong. Finally, he explains, the last 5 questions are for your digital space: Facebook, emails, Twitter, and blogs. Read others' posts and messages closely. Comment or reply with questions, and do it for at least 5 different people every day. In addition to that, use your posts and updates to ask more questions of your friends and followers. You may be surprised at how many people respond. These are lessons Bob Taylor of Taylor Guitars certainly takes to heart. When he heard that Dave Carroll's Taylor guitar had been damaged by United Airlines, he called Carroll directly and offered him 2 guitars of his choice. Imagine what might have happened if someone, anyone, at United exercised an ear for how to make things right with David Carroll. If they had, chances are high they would not have had to issue the following statement when Carroll's video went viral. "This has struck a chord with us. We are in conversations with one another to make what happened right, and while we mutually agree that this should have been fixed much sooner, Dave Carroll's excellent video provides United with a learning opportunity that we would like to use for training purposes to ensure all customers receive better service from us." It is often said that you live and learn. But perhaps an equally important lesson for us all is that if you listen and learn, you live more harmoniously. Chapter 5. Discuss what matters to them. At a dinner party, George Bernard Shaw sat next to a young man who proved to be a bore of historic proportions. After suffering through a seemingly interminable monologue, Shaw cut in to observe that between the two of them, they knew everything there was to know in the world. "How is that?" asked the young man. "Well," said Shaw, "you seem to know everything except that you're a bore, and I know that." Not quite the impression the young man was aiming for, but it proves an important point. When it comes to mattering to others, you must discuss what matters to them. Assume all else will fall on deaf, or in this case, dull ears. This is an interesting principle to consider, given the spirit in which the vast majority of people communicate today. Most messages are primarily meant to educate others about our lives or our products, to reveal compelling portions of ourselves we think others would be attracted to. While this appears to be an assertive strategy, it is actually a passive strategy in that it requires others to connect with us. Like a banner ad on a website waiting to be clicked, we offer up digital ads of our best selves, hoping others will be compelled to engage. The trouble is, that's marketing monologue, not relational dialogue. It's assumption, not assimilation. When assumption guides our efforts to befriend or influence others, the results end up on the wrong side of memorable. In 1810, U.S. General William Henry Harrison, then governor of the Indiana Territory, was negotiating with Tecumseh in order to try to prevent open hostilities. He ordered a chair to be brought for the Native American chief. The man who brought it said, "Your father, General Harrison, offers you a seat." "My father!" Tecumseh exclaimed. "The sun is my father, and the earth is my mother, and on her breast I will lie." Ignoring the chair, he stretched himself out on the ground. Today's biggest enemy of lasting influence is the sector of both personal and corporate musing that concerns itself with the art of creating impressions without consulting the science of need ascertainment. Not only is this method presumptuous, but it is a poor business tack. What the world needs more of, what Carnegie espoused 75 years ago, is bridge-building dialogue. This begins when you flip the modern spirits of marketing and social media on their heads and begin all interactions with a mind for what matters to the other person. This starts, as we have said, with listening. Once you know what matters to others through a practice of longer listening, you can then truly engage them by putting such matters at the forefront of your interactions. If you're talking business, this process is about putting the customer back into customer relationship management, an endeavor that blogger Doc Searles once pointed out is more often about management than the customer. "Everyone is wrong about influence, except your customers," writes power blogger and business strategist Valeria Maltoni. "Think about that before you get into trouble for not delivering meaningful results," she says. True influence flows from drawing together people with shared interests. It's a process of identifying areas of relevancy among your customers and prospects, community building, and allowing others to amplify your influence as you meet their needs. You'll be chasing the popular kids, even those who demur, until the cows come home if you keep thinking that influence is about you. It's not. And you don't need the following of a celebrity to build something of significance. You are ultimately building a community when you initiate interactions with what matters to others. And a community is what really matters to you, whether you're building a brick-and-mortar business, launching a new brand, or planning an important reunion. Sure, there is an initial connection, and you need to make it. But much of marketing and social media today is only about the connection point, gaining another follower, notching another fan, claiming another customer. Often forgotten is the long-term plan. Businesses call it a customer retention strategy, but it is best thought of as a lively, meaningful dialogue among a community of friends. If the foundation of all long-term success is the establishment of trust-based relationships, then the goal of all interactions should be to convey value as soon and as often as possible. There are common hurdles to overcome. Jason travels to Senegal's most remote regions a few times a year. He first traveled with a non-profit that led him there. He returns today because he still learns there. Recently, one of the village elders pulled him aside on a 115-degree afternoon to ask him a most urgent question. How did people in North America live? Jason explained that most lived in individual houses somewhat akin to the huts in the village. Others lived in apartments stacked on top of and next to each other to form bigger buildings. And all of these homes, the elder inquired, they have walls all around? Yes, replied Jason. But why? To keep themselves safe from bad weather, and sometimes from bad people, and to protect the things in their home, and to give privacy. Oh, no, the elder replied. That is backward. In their village, he explained, they had torn down the walls to keep themselves safe. You see, too many things hide behind walls. If we tear down the walls for all to see, then we are all safer. We live in a modern world, and in the modern world we put up walls. There are firewalls for our computers, mortar walls for our estates, and wood and wire fences for our farms and family yards. Then there is the great wall of diffuse social interaction. It can lead to a level of influence that exists outside relationship, an influence founded on followership, but not friendship. Open leadership author and social media maven Charlene Lee warns about the danger of such fortified digital influence. In a recent interview, she noted the biggest concern, a false sense of security. There is a difference between a friend and a fan, she explained. Fans have a smaller sense of commitment, smaller levels of interest. There is a continuum of loyalty whereby fans stand at one end and friends at the other. Influence occurs across the continuum, but it is more certain and lasting on the friend's end. The easiest way to prove Lee's point is to go online and try to buy a Facebook friend. It can't be done. Companies galore will sell you Facebook fans, and they can assure you lots of Twitter followers, but leave it to social media to shine a bright light on the great truth that no true friend can be bought. When are we going to learn that millions of followers does not always equal influence? Blogged Canadian Mitch Joel, author of Six Pixels of Separation and one of the iMedia 25, Internet Marketing Leaders and Innovators. He continued, it's a game, business, that worked well until the proper analytics and platforms were put in place. Smaller, stronger groups are where influence lies. The brands that are winning true influence are winning, as opposed to hashtag winning, because they have people who are having real interactions with other real human beings, and those interactions are truly meaningful. It is much more practical, realistic, for businesses to think about using these opportunities to connect and have a sincere engagement instead of trying to rack up their numbers. Newton Minow was the influential head of the Federal Communications Commission under President John F. Kennedy. He later went on to serve in various other prestigious public and private sector jobs. When asked what his secret was, he said that it all came down to his college major. He'd majored in semantics,